Utah Foundation's project on social capital has included a series of reports on that idea and how it might apply to communities in Utah. Social capital is the term coined by Harvard professor Robert Putnam that looks at the non-tangible assets of social cohesion that bind communities in ways that enhance growth, bring together diverse groups, and create the foundation for cooperation and democracy. The project was guided by members of Utah Foundation's Board of Trustees, including Sandy City Council member Aaron DeKaiser.
I think it would be awesome if there were different data sets that we could get a hold of. And I'm not a researcher, so I don't know the intricacies of doing that, but it would be interesting to see how this turned out if you were using different data.
And that question brought together Utah Foundation President Sean Tigan and Senior Analyst Christopher Collard with DeKaiser for a roundtable discussion. You're listening to Utah Thrives, the Utah Foundation podcast. I'm Dan Bomas. Utah Foundation's series on social capital looked at a total of 34 metrics, everything from volunteerism and religious participation to family health and civic engagement. Utah, it turns out, leads the nation in these combined analytics. But finding data sources for many of them has been a challenge to the researchers and prompted a thoughtful exploration of how the broad issue of social capital can be measured.
Having read the report, I've just had questions about the way that we're measuring social capital. I recall one instance, I think maybe we're using married women with children as a measure. And to me, there's a lot of unmarried families with children that are excluded from that, and I think we should include them. So like Sean was saying, I think it would be awesome if there were different data sets that we could get a hold of. And I'm not a researcher, so I don't know the intricacies of doing that, but it would be interesting to see how this turned out if you were using different data.
What do you suspect, even if you don't have the numbers to back it?
I don't know what I suspect. It might be fairly similar. I mean, I think the Utah Foundation does a really good job in their research projects, and it's on the right path. But I do think you could maybe get into some granular differences about the way societies interact and stuff if you looked at different things. Another thing I thought about was like healthcare outcomes. I think if you had data for that, you could see how well a society is functioning together and those relationships. So, yeah.
Yeah, we think about this too, Aaron. Like when we originally put this project together or visualized this project way back when, we didn't know how we were going to weight the data. So we didn't know how much emphasis we would give to each of the data points. So we've got these 34 data points. Should they all be weighted kind of the same, or should we weight them in a different way? And what we decided to come up with was we organized those 34 data points into 7 buckets, and then each of those buckets gets the same weight. So when we think about the focus on future generations versus social cohesion versus social trust, each of these kind of areas get the same weight. But you know, going back to this question about you know, we've had people ask, like, why do you use this married couples kind of metric? Why does it have to be people that are married?
And we don't use married couples anymore, for example.
We
used the married couples last year, but when we talked about it, we were like, this kind of overlaps a lot with like birth to married mothers. So one thing we did change.
Oh, birth to married mothers. Sorry, that was the one. Yeah.
Instead of married couples, we actually switched that to how many adults are in the household. And you know, when we look at birth or the births to married mother, we're not saying that we're not counting people who are unmarried mothers. What we're focused on is if you have two parents in a household, you generally have, like on average, you have twice as many social connections in that household. Like
because
you've
got two parents
with
instead
two
of
parents
one
instead
one
of just one. And you know, and then there's also households that aren't necessarily built around the nuclear family with parents and children all living that. Sometimes you have multi-generational households that again bring additional networks in to kind of benefit the whole family. And that's kind of one of the reasons we switched out this just looking at married households to like how many adults per household, in order to try and try and cover more bases, I guess. That was one change we recently made.
Yeah, and we actually made a lot of changes this year in order to make those adjustments. And we took those changes from this year and then went back over time, all the way back from the kind of what we see as the beginning of the study, because we just wanted to look back in time to see how these numbers change over time. Because this is really the second time we did this, but in essence, the way we've kind of taken these data over the past, it's kind of like the fourth time we've done this. And we see that I think the improvements we made are important, but there are probably, I suspect, the next time we do this, we're going to find a few data points where it's like, you know what, that's not quite right either. Is there something else that represents what we're seeking out better in terms of these networks that we have individually and the barriers to some of those metrics, like I brought up earlier, things like social trust and that sort of thing.
Now, one of the things that you concluded in your reports was that Utah is doing pretty well on a lot of measures of social capital, but you compared Utah to other Western states and discovered that Nevada wasn't doing so well. And perhaps, Aaron, that's where you had a bone to pick with the research.
I mean, yeah, I do spend a lot of time in Nevada and part of a neighborhood down there, which has its own social connections and things like that. And to me, it's been a very different experience. I reminisce about growing up in Midvale in the 80s and attending block parties, and all the neighbors knew each other. I could go down the street and get a fudgesicle from any of the neighbors or a popsicle, whatever. And I had that same feeling down there, participating in the block parties and things like that, which I haven't really felt necessarily in Utah, in my neighborhood. I think the county health department shut down block parties a number of decades ago for, you know, health concerns and sharing food. But
people getting sick from those fudgesicles.
Well, maybe, yeah, I don't know.
Or
they,
the crab
if they sit
salad.
Out too long, yeah. Yeah. But no, I mean, I'm not a part of other, you know, like the dominant religion here, which plays a huge part in creating the social capital that it has in Utah. And I would think that makes us, you know, it's a reason that we're number one. But I do think that maybe different people can have different experiences. On the whole, though, as the state, as those metrics are measured versus Utah, obviously they're worse off.
So what works in Nevada for social cohesion in neighborhoods?
Well, I think it might, I don't know about the other neighborhoods, obviously, that I'm not a part of, but the one that I am, there's a Facebook group, they do annual gatherings, they have, you know, Christmas events, Halloween events, yard sales. There's a lot of involvement in the community from realtors and different organizations, nonprofits that work a lot in the neighborhoods. And so it's just a feeling of connection that I have really strongly there that contrasts with here.
It'd be interesting though, I wish that we could do something like this and have the data that are granular enough to be able to look at this on a community by community basis. Like you brought up Midvale earlier, and these block parties in this very tight-knit community that you had grown up. I think that even in my neighborhood, sometimes I go down the street, I'm coming home on my bike or something, and I'm like, why is this cool gathering of people not happening on my street? But then every once in a while, those things do happen on my street as well. So I think it probably is kind of hit and miss, kind of depending on neighborhood, and it'd be interesting to be able to really delve in and look at that on a really smaller kind of community level, like your street versus having to compare state by state.
Yeah, it would be interesting to look at that. I would assume too, over time, as the neighborhood changes, your social capital can go up or down.
Yeah, and absolutely would change. You see the change. You see the makeup of a community change, and then suddenly, maybe that one family that was making those community parties happen, they move out, and then it's like, who's filling Barb and Franco's spot? Because now we're stuck with none of these parties. Like we're stuck with a boring neighborhood. It's hard to say.
Excuse me. Are there perhaps occupational aspects of social cohesion that can be measured? I mean, one of those, I guess, would be income. But neighborhoods where more people are employed, do they have a higher level of social capital?
I don't think we look specifically at whether or not you're employed. You probably could make an argument that, you know, people who are employed generally see the same people at work every day and probably have extended networks there. That could be something that we could consider in the future. We have spent a lot of time just talking about like community life or like what is your neighborhood like there. But we do have a lot of other factors too that we look at, including just like social mobility. How well do you have a chance to move forward in your community or move upward? We also look at social trust in terms of like, is your state a place where you can kind of trust other people?
And I think tied into this question though is like how we spend our time. So if you spend time alone, you're probably not, you either, if you have a lot of time alone on your own, you may not have good, strong social capital, you're maybe not building it, but if you're active with your friends and neighbors and active with your family, and like you said, Dan, you're active with people at work, then maybe you're building social capital that way. I think that's, talking about social cohesion in terms of incomes, like one of the things we do in this, and I think that that's probably a pretty important part of this, is that Utah has a very robust middle class.
What do you mean by a robust middle class?
The way you measured it, Christopher, okay, is so
the way we measure middle class is we look at kind of, is there a big clump? When you say robust middle class, I'm not sure, like, that doesn't necessarily mean all the people in the middle are earning enough to meet their needs. When we look at middle class, we're looking how many people are in the middle class. We have a large, most of the population is in the middle class in our state.
And in fact, a larger proportion of the population than anywhere else, or we're definitely
one of the top states, if not the top.
Yeah.
But Aaron, the middle class is not the only place where social cohesion takes place.
No, it takes place across all economic variations. I do think it's interesting though, you could, and I wonder if our research points to anything in this, but you can have people with the same income and have very different outcomes for social cohesion, right?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. And that's what, you know, one of the reasons why we use so many metrics in this is because there is no one metric. There is no, we're not surveying 20,000 people across the United States to see what their or more than 20,000 probably to get a good number to see what their social capital is. So we're using a bunch of metrics that try to figure out and tease out some of the experiences that people are having by factors that maybe in some small way align with either providing larger amounts of social capital or are the result of higher social capital.
And I would completely agree that any one factor that we choose to focus on is probably not a great measure of social capital. Our goal is by looking at all these together that hopefully we're able to paint a little bit more of a picture.
Aaron, what else should be included?
Well, I think, with the internet these days, it has a connective effect, but also a disconnective effect. And so I think it would be really interesting to get data on how people's participation in, online groups and things like that affects
things like Nextdoor?
Sure. Things like Nextdoor, all the social media platforms.
It's definitely something we're trying to figure out how to address.
But we do in some ways have a little bit of a negative bias about this kind of activity, because one of the metrics that we include, especially in kind of the focus on future generations, that category includes things like how much time we spend together with our kids at meals, but it also includes screen time. So if we've got kids that are on the screen a lot, and maybe it's not social media, maybe it's video games, or maybe it's TV or whatever the case may be, but that screen time is a big factor that we include in this, and we're not doing great. We're not doing so great on that one. We're also not doing great at eating meals with our kids here in the state for whatever reason. That's not one of the metrics that we really excel at. But in terms of focusing on future generations, we probably do very well at things like having babies and having lots of kids in our homes. And that kids in our home thing is kind of a big deal, because it's like if I'm a single kid, I have the connections maybe at school just for myself, but if I've got three siblings and they can introduce me to some kids, or the, some neighbor kids come over because of them, then suddenly my network is bigger, including, you know, with all those connections at school and beyond. So I think, and into the future. So I think there's some benefits there, I think. As a parent of a single child, we thought about that a lot, especially when she was particularly young growing up.
Are there community celebrations or service projects, perhaps, that you can count? I know every year, Bountiful and Centerville do a 9/11 day of service on the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. And one year they were clearing fire breaks, and another year they were doing something else in the community that didn't necessarily have anything to do with, you know, any threat to the community, just a way to build up the neighborhood and make things stronger. Is there a way to count those? Or perhaps even, you know, in Midvale, I know they have an annual summer celebration. Do you count those and how people participate in those?
Yeah,
we have two metrics that come close to that. One is there's a survey that's done every other year or so by the census. It's conducted by the census. And two of the questions kind of surround, like, how much do you volunteer? And they look at volunteerism, volunteering for various organizations. And then they have a different question that's kind of similar that asks, you know, have you ever spent any time trying to do something for your neighborhood? Have you ever spent time the last year trying to do some sort of community project for your neighborhood to improve your neighborhood? And so those are definitely, those are the two questions we have that kind of hit closest to that.
And we brought this up, you know, in terms of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, you know, there's a lot of membership for that church in the state. And you see, you know, we in Utah have always been very good at volunteering. When you look at both of those metrics, Utah excels and is very high in terms of those metrics. And part of that may be because of that kind of church involvement. And we also, if I remember right, just being involved in a church, if you go to church, you're perhaps increasing your social capital. That's kind of one of the things we like to think about. And Utah is also very high in terms of people that attend church services regularly, because you're seeing people maybe in your neighborhood or people that have some similarity to you. And then what are the benefits from that? Maybe you help somebody helps your kid get an internship somewhere, or somebody helps you figure out how to get a job, or somebody helps your spouse figure out how to get some more training or whatever, and you can gain those kind of relationships both at perhaps at that church service or in one of those volunteer activities or helping out in your neighborhood. So there's some the big benefits there, and we do very good, very well in really all three of those metrics in Utah. And that's really three of the metrics that help propel us to the kind of the top of the list in terms of states with strong social capital.
Yeah, we've talked about how if the Utah Foundation could get, you know, share in the data that cities can collect. Sandy City surveys our residents pretty regularly, and we have plenty of community activities where, you know, people come out. We have the Healing Field, where the, you know, community comes together to put out those over 3,500 flags. We have the Sandy Beautification Days. There's lots of things that if we could just share in that data or create programs to measure it would be really interesting. I want to just really quick go back to something that Christopher said about surveys, because that is another idea I've had. If you could just survey people, the data would be right there. So is that something the Utah Foundation does, the surveys, or are there larger national or statewide surveys that provide any insights?
We love
surveys. We love to do surveys. We love when other people do surveys. We really like surveys.
I suspect that a survey to do this across the United States to compare every state would be larger than the annual Utah Foundation budget. And I'm just shooting from the hip here, but I suspect it's probably somewhere pretty close to that. And so we do the next best thing, which is use other people's surveys.
Yeah.
On data that aren't exactly social capital, but that are close in some way to social capital, bring all those 34 metrics together, and hopefully, you know, get close to the mark in terms of kind of judging what where we're really at.
Well, yeah. What would you like to see then, Aaron? How would you like to see the approach guide the next batch of social capital research?
Well, I think, as Sean mentioned, and Christopher has talked about, they're changing the approach to doing it, and every year they learn a little bit and things like that. Like we've talked about, I think there are healthcare metrics, there's social media metrics, there are other things that we can think about in terms of our social capital to add to that list of 34. That's a lot, but I would assume there are hundreds if you could get the data points on them. So I would just like to see a broader study of the topic and just see what impacts that has.
Aaron DeKaiser is an at-large member of the Sandy City Council and a member of the Utah Foundation Board of Trustees. He was speaking with Utah Foundation President Sean Tigan and senior analyst Christopher Collard. The full series of Utah Foundation reports on social capital can be found on our website, utahfoundation.org. Utah Foundation is a private, nonprofit research organization. Our mission is to inform and engage Utahns with illuminating, independent, nonpartisan public policy research. Your support and comments on our work and the Utah Thrives podcast are always welcome. I'm Dan Bomas. Thanks for listening.